trucking on. And I'm trucking on. Move her on down the line, another town will do me fine. I'm trucking on. I'm trucking on.
Howdy, friends, and welcome to Trucking On. I'm your host, Ward Richmond. I really appreciate you tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy the show. Clint Riley, welcome to Trucking On.
Thanks, Ward.
How are you doing today?
Man, I'm doing awesome. You know, it's a few days before Christmas, and we just had a company Christmas party and getting ready to have some family in town. And anyway, we've had a good fourth quarter, so...
Heck yeah. It's my favorite time of the year for sure. Yeah. I love this time in the real estate business, especially. I don't know about many other businesses, but it kind of starts slowing down right now. And next week, I'm gone. I'm going to go down to the ranch with my parents and the children. Looking forward to it.
It's that time of year where you can kind of like start taking inventory, you know? Like, what do we really do in 2023? Like the story I was just telling you, you know? It's like we do so many things and so many deals, like you just forget about all the good stuff, you know, and then you're just, you know, putting out fires and, you know, so it's good to kind of take inventory of what you just did, what you accomplished. And then, you know, it's also time to start thinking like, man, what do we do? What are we doing in 24? What are we, you know, independent of what we're dealt, you know, with the economy or interest rates or the Fed or the market, you know, what are we going to do, you know?
What do you, how do you feel about going into next year right now?
You know, people ask me that, and I just say this is when I do my best work, you know.
In choppy times, you would say?
Choppy times, man.
It's choppy times, right?
You know, I'm built for this, you know. I'm always looking for, you know, a different deal or a better value proposition. You know, just buying into a normal market, you know, for me feels difficult. But buying into turbulence feels like a better time to find opportunity. So, anyway, I like to think this is when I do my best work. So I'm pretty excited about it. You know, I do think the Fed has done a pretty good job of inflicting pain and damage on the real estate market.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, in our chair, you got to, you know, figure out how to do damage control and problems that you may have. Fortunately, we don't have a ton. Most of our stuff seems to be working pretty well. And, you know, then you got to be ready to go because that window for opportunity, at least in Dallas-Fort Worth, you know, feels like a pretty small window. You know, when you think back to Great Recession, you know, it was kind of a long window. But back then, we weren't the number one real estate market in the country. You know, and I would argue that we probably are top one, two, or three today. So a lot of capital wants to be here. A lot of really smart, talented real estate guys. And this is a super fun place to do real estate because the peer group of guys that do what you do and do what I do is you know, chock full of really great guys. So
no doubt. I met you right when I started in 2006, and I worked with Jeff Mercer,
yep,
and Robert Lynn, and I worked the Trinity Brook Hollow submarkets, and that's where you started and cut your teeth, right?
Yeah.
Bates and Myers,
yeah. A little bit of my story. I grew up 9 miles down a dirt road in East Texas. My mom was a school teacher, and my dad was a timber buyer, and you know, I went to Sam Houston State because that's the only college I could afford to go to and actually get in. You know, graduated 29 kids. So, man, I'm not sure I'm cut out for college or not. But
29 you know, kids in your graduating
29
class.
Kids in my graduating
what
class.
What high school?
Latexo High School, just outside of Crockett.
Did you, what was high school like there? Did you play sports? Did you, it was like six-man football or something?
We didn't even have football.
Really?
I played, if you're an athlete, you played everything. So, played baseball, played basketball, ran a little bit of track. You know, I worked my way through high school. I mean, I was, you know, I took several jobs and I'd play sports. And
what did you work doing?
I worked at HEB. I was a frozen food manager at HEB, and you know, I bought my own clothes, paid my own way, and that didn't bother me a bit. When I was 15, my dad was like, you know, I've got a 15-year-old right now, you know. Kind of moping around the house or playing video games, you know, they're kind of
living a different life.
Just walking around looking dumb half the time. And my dad was like, but I think you probably ought to go get a job. And I was like, I think you're right. So, you know, I went to the local grocery store, HEB, and walked in and shook hands with the manager. I'm like, man, I need to get a job. He gave me a job, and 30 days later, he gave me a department and said, man, why don't you run frozen food? 3 days a week, you know, 25 hours a week, that's what we've got. So I did that. And then when I graduated from high school, I mean, they thought enough of me that they called the store up there and they let me transfer. So I went to Huntsville and ran a, you know, as the HEB frozen food manager for 4 years. And
all through college.
They gave me a little college scholarship, and I did that all the way through college. You know, paid for some rent and a little bit of beer money and, you know, enough to live and get my way through college without any debt. So
what was Sam Houston State like?
Did you know,
you do a fraternity or what?
I did. Again, I told you I was kind of scared to go to college. I just didn't know. I just hadn't been around that many people. I mean, I'd been going to school with the same small group of people.
How many people are at Sam Houston State?
Back then, I would guess maybe 6,000. Right now, I'm guessing maybe 20,000. It's bigger now.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got into A&M. I got into Baylor. And I got into Sam Houston. But, man, I was not in the mindset to go to school. I really was having a good time as a teenager. And, but, you know, I knew it was time to go to college, and I did graduate top 10 or 15% of the 29 kids. So yeah. I went to, I decided to go to Sam Houston because it was like, you know, 30, 40 miles from home. And, you know, I knew I was going to be a business student. I knew, I mean, I was a kid selling candy out of his briefcase in the third grade. You know, I buy low, sell high, make money in between, add value. You know, it's always kind of been in my bit of my DNA. So
really, that's so cool.
You know, when they're like, what are you gonna major in?
I see that, but yeah, I had no thoughts about that at all when I was growing up.
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to go do business. So I went, interviewed with the business school, and they told me about it, and they're like, hey, you can do accounting, you can do finance, you can do economics, you can do marketing. And I just thought about it, and I'm like, finance, I think I'll do that, you know?
Yeah.
Because I grew up, you know, without many resources. So I'm like, man, in order for me to do anything big, I'm going to need to know about finance. So I wasn't sure I was going to be smart enough to do it or not, but, you know, worked out. I spent 4 years there, and I was doing frozen food at night and finance school during the day. And 4 years, I got a degree from there.
Finance school to me even sounds intimidating at this stage of my life. What does that entail? Like accounting and...
Yeah.
What did you feel like you walked away with, like skill-wise, from that? Did any like concrete skills that you learned?
You know, the basics of what we do now is really finance. You know, it's like you gotta use leverage. If you come from where I came from to where I gotta go, you know, there's no way to do it without the value of leverage. So, you know, understanding the basics of, you know, debt principles, real estate principles, you know, corporate finance. You know, but hey, at the end of the day, most of what I do, we've got pretty sophisticated finance models going here. We got four analysts sitting back there today, but you know, also I can generally do the math in my mind on, is this real estate deal going to work or not?
Right.
You know, I can size one up pretty quick, and it's just because we've been doing it a long time, not because I'm that smart. So
I'm good at knowing what math needs to be done, and telling someone like to put it in a spreadsheet for me, but I don't like if I had to go like put it in the spreadsheet and figure. I mean, I'm sure I could figure it out, but I'm better at the back of the napkin approach of analyzing most things.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can do some in your head, you can do some on your HP 10B plus or whatever finance calculator you use, and usually pretty close. So, I mean, it gets more complicated. You know, we've bought and sold quite a bit of office, and that gets a little more complicated because you got so many different tenants rolling in and out.
Yeah.
So much TILC, and so that gets to be a pretty complicated underwrite. But
so you got out and graduated with your finance degree, and then did you move to Dallas?
You know, Huntsville was maybe an hour from Houston, basically, and most all the people I went to college with were from Houston. I mean, I don't remember actually meeting any Dallas people, but when I got out of college, I'd had enough of the grocery industry. You know, they kind of wanted me to be an assistant store manager, and I was like, man, that's going to be 70 hours a week and nights and weekends. And I'm like, man, I want to do something else than that. You know, nothing wrong with that. I needed to do something else. So the job market wasn't very, very good. We were coming kind of out of that, you know, dot-com kind of tech bust.
When did you graduate college?
I graduated in May of 2002.
Okay.
So it's kind of right after that,
you know, right after 9/11.
Yeah, 9/11, Y2K, tech bust, like right at that time, the job market wasn't good. And, you know, I needed to make some money. You know, I just kind of had that feeling like, man, I don't want to go be a, do something to make $30,000 a year. Like, I got to have a chance to kind of change the trajectory for my life. And so I had some guys that had been recruiting me to go work. They called it in finance, but it was at a car dealership in Houston. So anyway, we go through this long interview process. They're like, hey, we're going to make you a finance guy at a car dealership. And hey, sound pretty good. They're like, man, you can make $100,000 a year. And I was like, sign me up. 22, need to make some money.
Heck yeah.
And so I show up out, you know, I turned down, I had a couple other job offers, turned those down. I get an apartment in Kingwood, Texas, and move out there, get an apartment. You know, they're like, hey, start Monday, show up, talk to this person. So I show up, and nobody's really expecting me. And then I find somebody, like, here, I'm Clint Riley, here I am. And they handed me a business card that said car sales trainee. And I was like, oh gosh, like this is going to be something. So,
it, you know, tricked you.
It felt like it, but, you know, I didn't really have any options at that point. I turned out all my job offers. I rented, signed a 6-month lease.
They give you a salary to do that?
I don't remember if it was a salary or a draw. It could have been a small salary and then the rest kind of commission. But that didn't really bother me. So I talked to the general manager. I'm like, man, this isn't really what you guys had told me. And he's like, well, I tell you what, I don't care what they told you. I'm the decision maker. Go sell more cars than anybody out here and I'll put you in finance. So anyway, I was like, okay, I'm here. I might as well go. So I went and my second month there, I sold, you know, the second most cars of anybody at the dealership. There's probably 20 salesmen. And a job happened to open up in finance and they put me back there. And so I get back into finance. And, you know, back then they would train you kind of how to package sale. Does that make sense? Have you ever seen have you ever been to a car dealer?
Yeah, like, it's like, hey, you want the tire, souped up tire package, and if you get a flat on the highway, and then this warranty and all these different
yeah,
things.
Yeah, so they say something to you like, hey, Mr. Richmond, you know, if you want to buy this.
I say no all the time to that now, but that would get me when I was like 22 years old. Like, oh, okay. That sounds good.
So you say, hey, Mr. Richmond, for $650 a month, I can say this Honda Civic, $650 at 72 months. You can take her home today, sign right there. You know, but what you don't know is they just sold you a credit life and disability, a bunch of this crap.
Oh, really?
A bunch of this crap. They'll sell you 8 or 9 products that you never know they sold you. And anyway, the whole thing to me felt like kind of a greasy scheme.
Little scam.
Right? So they weren't, the money, well, I did make money. I did it. I mean, I did make the money they were talking about, but, you know, I went home at night feeling kind of greasy, you know, it's like, man, I don't really love this. And, but it taught me a couple things. It taught me how to, you know, walk up and talk to a perfect stranger. It talked to me about how you better have a value proposition. And, it also taught me that, man, I've got to find a career that I can, you know, to sleep well at night. That's a great place for me to have a good career and, you know, be home. I was engaged to be married. I got married at the ripe old age of 22.
To Ashley,
you know, my wife.
I do.
She's great.
When did you meet Ashley?
I met her in Sam Houston. I met her the first day of her freshman year.
Okay.
And I was a sophomore, so I'd been there for a year.
Yeah.
So,
you just saw her?
We were in math class.
Yeah.
Of all places. And, you know, she showed up and sat behind me.
I did not know that. And, maybe I did. But
she, you know, she's pretty friendly. She struck up a conversation, and I'm left-handed. She's left-handed. She's like, "Say, I see you're left-handed too," or something like that. And then we kind of chatted.
She closed the deal.
We kind of chatted through the semester, and then she invited me to a Christmas party at the end of the semester. And it's like, heck, I'll show up. And I guess how many people showed up?
The two of you.
Just me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was great. She, anyway, I always joke with her about giving me a private Christmas party. But anyway, yeah, it was great. We met at a young age. And, you know, the beauty of that is, you know, we've got to make a lot of mistakes together and learn together, you know. So, you know, we got married.
So she went with you to the car dealership?
No, she had another semester. She graduated. Okay. She's smart. She graduated in 3.5 years. So I went to work at the car dealership, you know, did that thing. I did it, hung with it for about 6 months, about the length of the apartment lease. And, you know, I just had enough. It wasn't going to be my deal. So, anyway, I resigned. Ashley was graduating. she graduated that, I guess January. Yeah, January. We got married, you know, on January 4th of that year, right after she graduated. So now we're both 22, married, you know, neither one of us have jobs. I'm sure Dad loved that, you know?
Yeah.
But,
where'd you go on a honeymoon?
We went on a cruise, you know, some cheap carnival cruise, you know, the only thing we could afford. Matter of fact, funny story, I'd never even had sushi until that first carnival cruise.
Really?
Yeah. I was with her and we were married and it's like, hey, what's that? She's like, hey, that's sushi. She kind of looked at me like the biggest hick in the world because I just had no idea.
I don't think I had sushi until I was a senior in college, actually. So
my kids hammer sushi. My kids are 9, 11, and 14, and they've been eating sushi and drinking coffee since they were born.
Our children live in a different universe.
Man, they really do. So, so we get married and, man, I just always kind of thought, man, if you want to go somewhere and like hit it big, you go to Dallas. You know, even though I grew up in the pine trees, I was like, man, I think we need to go to Dallas. So she had gotten an internship with the GSA office here in Dallas. I think it might have paid $15 an hour or something. It's like a temporary to perm internship. And we're like, well, what are you going to do? I'm like, well, I don't know anybody from Dallas. I don't have a pedigree. I don't have a bunch of relationships here. So my uncle who married us, at the wedding, he's like, hey, you know, my college roommate has a little real estate company. They're in Dallas. His name's Floyd Bates, and gave me his card. And I didn't even have enough money for a hotel room. I came up here and spent the night with my aunt here in Irving off of Northgate, and spent the night with her, went over and shook hands with Floyd and Richard. And you know, they said, man, we'd train you here and let you take a shot at it. You know, it's hard business. It was a commission-only deal, and, you know, just kind of like the Mercer guys. You just get out there and figure it out and grind and see if you can make it happen, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I knew nothing about real estate. I didn't really know what commercial real estate even was, you know? I might have read about it in a textbook, but, you know, I didn't know how you made money doing it. I didn't know how you did tenant rep. I didn't know what a submarket was. And, you know, Floyd kind of drew a map for me of Brook Hollow, and... he's like, I tell you what, let me make this simple for you. If you just represent everybody on a best in a row, you're going to make a lot of money. And I was like, man, one street, you know, that sounds kind of doable, right? So anyway, they handed me a stack of business cards and a desk and drew a map of Brook Hollow and said, yeah, now you go out and make cold calls. I'm like, well, what's a cold call? So, you know, back then we had a Mapsco in one hand and we had the big black book that had everybody's phone number and who was running every company. And man, I loaded up and just went cold call all day long. Wore out shoe leather, man. I just, you know, about every three months, I'd have to get new shoes because.
What year was that?
Started in January 03.
Okay.
And did that, you know, and honestly at first, you know, it took me a while. Like, some of you other guys were successful much earlier than me, but it took me a couple of years, some years, you know.
I feel the same. And I mean, I didn't start doing it until I was 27. So that's different. And I'd been playing in my band, which was basically running a business, you know. And I'd worked 2 years leasing office space before that, but still. And then I'm working for Jeff Mercer and I'm working on all these deals that he's feeding me. So it's just different. But I've talked to so many people. It's funny, my dad did commercial real estate, but I never knew what he did. It's like, it was just elusive to me. Like I didn't get it. And like all through my childhood, I'd go drive around and look at land sites with him and stuff, but I can't explain it, but it just never clicked. Like, what do you do? I don't understand what you do. And he'd talk about brokers. He was a developer and then owned properties. So he'd talk about brokers, but I just never understood. Until I interned at the Staubach company and did all that. So I had all of this pedigree, really. Still didn't really know what it was. And then I really started when I was 27 being a broker. And yeah, you just start knocking on that first door. I didn't have fear necessarily of talking to someone, but I guess it was the fear that I didn't have a value proposition, that I did not understand my value proposition for years. I just like, yeah, I can go ask people, do you need, are you considering like doing anything with your real estate? Do you need help with your real estate or something? I knew what to say from the script, but then if they're like, yeah, then it's like, hire me. I specialize in the submarket. To a degree, I understood like, I know all the tenants here, but I did not believe in myself for many years.
Hi, I'm 22. Hire me.
Yeah.
You know, like who trusts a multi-million dollar decision to a 22-year-old?
No doubt.
So it's tough.
When did it click?
Well, man, I just scratched and clawed a little bit, you know, and I might have made 35 or 40 grand the first year, but we didn't really have client management. I didn't even have CoStar for the first number of years. So, I mean, what I learned is I learned to retain a ton of information in my head. You know, I could drive down every street and tell you which company was there, who the president was, and how many times he had told me no, you know? So I was just like, really,
and you memorized it all.
I was really just aggregating data in my head. You know, I'd take some notes and whatever, but I did it enough in the same area that I could just kind of regurgitate it to you. You know, and I think, you know, the first year I might have made 40, and you know, the second year I might have made 80. You know, and that's kind of what my peers are making. You know, 75 or 80, and I was like, okay, you know, at least I'm not, you know, I'm not making more than anybody, but I'm at least probably keeping pace with guys that are out of a couple of years out of college. And but the thing that really happened to me that changed my life was, you know, and oh, going back to Jeff Mercer, man, he was the kingpin back then. I mean, he had every listing, every sign. I mean, and when you grow up, if you could be Jeff Mercer, I mean, you know, that's what you wanted to be. He had that submarket, you know, dominated, and he was probably making $1 million a year, you know, way before anybody even heard of doing that, you know.
For sure.
You know, nobody was doing that back then.
Yeah.
I think the thing that changed my life was, you know, Floyd and Richard had bought some buildings, and they're like, man, if you ever find anything good, like, let's buy it, you know? And I kind of kept that in my mind. And then, man, I was out cold calling one day. Good things happen if you cold call long enough. And maybe about 2.5 years in, you know, I was driving around in the design district, and I saw this lady getting out of a Cadillac. Back then, everybody in real estate drove Cadillacs, and she was putting this Century 21 sign up on a building over on Edison, you know, Edison right between Dragon and Slocum. And, you know, I got out of the car, shook hands and said, you know, I'm Clint Riley. Are you going to sell this building? And she said, yeah, we're going to sell it. You know, we don't know what we're asking, but it's about to go on the market. And I said, well, could I send you an offer? She's like, yeah, just fax it right here, honey. So she handed me her card, circled her fax number, and, you know, went back and hand wrote a NATCAR contract and faxed it on over to her. And
How much per square foot?
Oh, I think like $375,000, like $50 a foot, $50 a foot,
yeah.
You know, nothing. And, you know, about 30 minutes later, I heard the fax machine beeping. Remember, they'd beep when the fax would come in. And, man, I go over there, and sure enough, I've got a, they can counter like $5,000 or something like that. So I've got a signed counter contract for like $375,000 for a building in the design district. So it comes back over, and I'm like, man, I think
Was it like a 10,000, 20,000 foot?
Yeah, maybe like 10,000 foot or some small one, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm like, man, I've got something. So I go in there and talk to Floyd and Richard, and you know, their eyes got kind of big. They're like, oh yeah, you're gonna make some money on this one. So we went to Gerald Hooker at Brook Hollow Bank back then, who wound up helping me immensely later in my career. Like, hey, got this deal. We want to borrow money on it. And I think they might have loaned us 85 or 90% on the deal. And, you know, I don't think we ever made a mortgage payment. We closed, took possession, and I think we flipped it. You know, I don't think we even made a payment. I think we resold it, you know, pretty quick and made several hundred thousand dollars on it. And
did you guys split it three ways?
Yeah, something like that. I may have gotten a little more for originating it or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then, industrial rents were $2. Sales were $20 a foot. So, you know, we just didn't make very much money. So, yeah, I mean, if you do a big tenant rep deal or, you know, you do a 50,000 square foot industrial.
That building today would be like $300 a foot or something.
Yeah, maybe 400 a foot.
Something like that.
Yeah, so, yeah. But man, it just got in my DNA. Like, you know, I make a $5,000 commission or I just made $100,000 or $200,000, you know, and that happened to me at a pretty early age, like 20, I might've been 25.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, that was cool. You know, so that was more than I was making in a whole year. So, but you know, back then industrial real estate was not cool. You know, it's like you wanted to be an office guy, you know, that's where, you know, those guys getting paid on $20 rents and $30 rents and,
yeah,
you know, So nobody really wanted to be an industrial guy, but, you know, it got in my DNA and I just like, man, I can do that again. So, you know, a few months later, we bought a package of little deals over on Levy, you know, one on Market Center and a couple over on Levy, and bought a package of 3,000 footers and, for 50 bucks a foot, 50, 60 bucks a foot.
Yeah.
I think we turned around and sold them all for 100 bucks a foot and just thought, you know, made 30 or 40 bucks a foot, you know, and I thought we just hit it out of the park. And for back then, you know, we kind of did hit it out of the park. So, you know, it just kind of got in my DNA.
So how much of your income was coming from buildings versus brokerage?
Like, you know, I kept brokering because you don't know when that's going to happen. You know how often that's going to happen. The reason I was able to do that is because I knew exactly what every trade was.
Because you're brokering.
Yeah, because I'm brokering. I know what every sale comp is, you know, and what happened. I mean, most of it wasn't even off market. You know, it was, you know, nobody, if you weren't in the market every day, you didn't know if that thing was worth 40 bucks a foot or 10 bucks a foot. So, you know,
yeah.
Somebody that went down there every day would put something on the market as 15 bucks a foot. I'd just go buy it.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, and my brokerage business picked up. So, you know, I got maybe my third year in.
I had no idea you were doing all of that when I met you as a broker, because I just thought you were a broker and we're working on deals together.
Yeah. And I was really for my day job.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that was important because, you know, like I said, I still needed to borrow a lot of money to do this stuff. And I wasn't doing a ton. I was doing two deals a year. I mean, my goal was, you know, if I can do two little deals a year, and, you know, looking back, I wish I'd have leased some of that. But, you know, you couldn't back then. You pay 40 bucks a foot and lease it for $2 or $3. You just don't make any money.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, so we did that.
Were you flipping it to users typically?
Sometimes users, sometimes investors. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it, we just flipped to other investors, you know, and, so yeah, that's kind of how it got in my DNA. You know, after I'd done that and got some reps doing that, it's like, man, this brokerage thing is fun, but this, I might be an investor, you know?
Yeah.
And so I spent 6 or 7 years with Floyd and Richard and still have a good regard and relationship with those guys. But
I recruited you.
Then you called me. You know, my wife had worked at the Staubach company with Sharon and Brant, and then you called me, and about the time she had went to Transwestern, and then you were at Transwestern, and then Brandon Sharon went to Transwestern, and, you know, I was getting recruited, you know, I'd been doing it 6-7 years, you know, and it was getting time to kind of, you know, up my game a little bit. So I'd been getting recruited, and, you know, you called me, it's like, what do you think? And I'm, you know, I'd gotten close with some guys, but I just never got real comfortable with them. And, you know, always liked you and talked to Brant. You know, Brant's a great salesman.
So he,
you know, Hillman Sharon, you know, we had lunch and they're like, hey, man, if you want to do it, come do it. And I was like, I'm in, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't really need to think about it. I was like, man, and that was in the Great Recession too. So it's like, man, the Thanksgiving of 08, I had like 7 deals under contract, and I came back from that week of Thanksgiving, every deal that I had terminated, every one. And I was like, man, this is going to be ugly. So I might as well go change flags, figure out how I can learn from some, you know, different folks. And just really it was a learning move, you know. I got to go somewhere else. And I, you know, I thought Transwestern was a pretty good balance for me. I told them up front, hey, I'm part investor. So if that's a problem for you, let me know. And they're like, we actually like that about you.
Yeah,
so
we want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So that worked out, and you know, showed up there, and we had a good little industrial team with 10 or 15 people on it. And
I learned so much during those years. Robert Lynn, I think I have a pretty similar background to you in those early years, like the Robert Lynn ways. I think Floyd and Richard were at Robert Lynn.
Yeah, for sure.
So they kind of, same approach, submarket, door to door, and then getting to go work with all that crew that came over from Staubach at Transwestern with Brant and Sharon and Bill DeLaChapelle and then like Jim Hazard, Brett Owens, all like coming from Henry S. Miller. It was just this great, John Fulton, of course, so many great brokers, and then learning from all of those folks, but really learning that Staubach way of teaming on things and just how polished they were. and how they would go after these big corporate accounts. That was my first exposure to seeing that. And Robert Lynn, I felt like, don't go call on companies if you recognize their name. Just leave those.
Well,
to
you
stop
just didn't think you just didn't think you had a chance to land it.
No,
it you know,
calling local businesses, and that was my focus until I met them, and then it's like, oh, this is possible. That's when I shifted my DNA to focusing on corporate tenant rep. I wish it had gone your way also, because I still have not got, I mean, I don't know. I'm getting into it now finally as a 45-year-old, but buying those buildings, that is such a cool thing to have started doing at that age.
Yeah.
So then when did you, I left Transwestern in 2012, and then they started ESRP and all, like Emmett Smith, that's now Cressa.
Yeah.
So when was that? Like, 2013 or something?
You know, I don't remember exactly the year.
You didn't go though, did you?
I didn't go. You know, like I said, I had high regard for Sharon and Brant, and you know, I wasn't quite ready. I wasn't quite there. You know, I knew, you know, all right, they're going to build a national tenant rep team, and they're great at that. But you know, I'm an investor pretending to be a submarket guy. You know, I was like, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to be my thing or not. So, anyway, those guys were really successful and had a good run there. And man, we just made a lot of good friends, you know, during that time, you know,
no doubt.
And we learned a lot. We grew together and, you know, we've all kind of went different directions, but also have all had really good careers. So, it was a good time.
Tim Wheeler was there.
I talked to Vila last week.
I haven't talked to him in a long time.
Yeah, awesome guy.
I got to get him on here.
For sure. He will do it.
Oh, I know he will. And then I remember seeing you one day and you're like, yeah, man, I quit being a broker. When was that? Do you remember?
Probably about 2015 or 16.
Yeah.
Some of my guys were like, man, you're a pretty good broker. You could actually be a really good broker if you weren't distracted with your investment habits. But, you know, some guys approached me. Well, I was doing a bunch of things. We started doing some storage conversions. We were starting to do some industrial build-to-suits, you know, or we were chasing some industrial build-to-suits. And, you know, I was still buying and flipping stuff in kind of the design district in Brook Hollow. And, you know, I just felt, all right, I'm being disingenuous to my passion. Like, I really need to, you know, put the brokerage business down, and I need to focus on what I really want to do. And I'd been able to build a good enough net worth where I could kind of afford to put down that paycheck, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't loaded, but also wasn't going to starve to death either, you know? So, you know, and then it just took off. But what I thought was going to happen is, you know, I'm just going to go out and I'm going to get an analyst and two of us are going to buy some deals, you know? And, goodness gracious, man, it's turned into so much more than that, you know? But it's been a wild ride and I wouldn't trade a day of it, you know? It's been, other than, you know, marrying my wife and having my three children, it's just been one of the coolest things that's ever happened to me. I don't regret a second of it. It's been hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And also the most rewarding, most challenging. It's been fun.
And I mean, we started chatting before we started the podcast today, and you told me you just had the Christmas party and there are 80 people there. It's like 40-ish employees and their spouses. And you got up to give a recap of what you guys did this year. Like, you give us a high level.
Yeah. So we bought, you know,
you have 40 staff here.
Yeah. Yeah. So we do, we have
is it industrial?
We have
industrial capital.
Well, let me just tell you. So we have a construction company that it's its own company. It's got its own guys. You know, we have the private equity company, which raises money, makes promotes, buys property, syndicates kind of LPGP money, in ways. We have a build to suit business that, you know, we've built buildings in, I think, 6 states. You know, we have a land strategy. I mean, we're probably up to, you know, 800 or 900 acres, industrial or soon to be industrial here in Dallas Fort Worth. So we've been active doing that. You know, we've invested in some opcos. So we've got a steel company in Longview, that we're partners in, and that's gone well. So
you buy the steel from the construction company to build the building?
No, it's really not even it's not integrated with that, but it's you know, just completely different business.
Just a deal,
you know, it's a steel wholesale company. They buy steel and, you know, sell it to, you know, machine shops, oil and gas service companies. But, you know, we got that through a real estate deal, you know. So anyway, man, we're doing a lot of different things. So at the Christmas party, I ask Rachel, she's our COO. I'm like, you know, I've just been busy. We had so much going on of late. We just closed on 60 acres, but I'm like, man, tell me, what do we do in 23? And she handed me the list, you know. It's easy to forget like all the good stuff. It's easy to focus on the problems or the fire drill, you know. So, you know, when I looked at the list, I'm like, holy crap. Like, you know, we bought a 240,000 square foot office tower. We built three spec industrial buildings. We bought several hundred acres of industrial land. You know, we raised a fund. We've got three to four more projects coming out of the ground. You know, we've added five or six key players to our executive team. And it's like, damn, we're doing big shit. And, you know, like I told you, I'm still a little bit redneck. I don't think that's ever gonna leave. So,
nor should it.
So at the Christmas party,
we're doing some big shit.
So at the Christmas party, I'm like, you know, and also Rachel says to me, she's like, hey, you just pretend that everybody knows what y'all do around here. But some people don't. We got accountants, we got, engineers, like not everybody really knows.
It's like me growing up with my dad not knowing what he did.
Yeah, exactly. and in some regards, you know, we've chosen to kind of fly under the radar. And, you know, up until a year ago, we had 100 LinkedIn followers, right? That's always kind of been my deal. You know, I don't need the publicity. I don't need the fame. Like, I wanted to run a good business. I want to go do good deals. I want to be a good fiduciary to our investors. And,
so I'm an investor, by the way.
You are an investor. And
I have to disclose that to the audience.
Yeah, yeah, you are. And we've got a ton of real estate guys that are invested in our deals. And
I saw like all the LPs on that the fund, and I'm also an investor through Trinity and
really
your deals too. I double downed.
Well, you should.
And you didn't mention you build the spec buildings, but you've leased most of them.
Oh, and
most of it, right?
And
sold one.
Yeah. So and we're building a 80-acre IOS park. Spec buildings out there, and I mean, the list just kept going on. And anyway, so I get up at the Christmas party, and I'm like, hey, for all you people, I want you to know I love you. I know what we do is hard. The reason that we do it is hard, you know, it's work. That's okay. But, you know, I love you guys. And if you want to know what we do around here, we do big shit. And then with it for 24, and I'd had about one cocktail, so I might have been a little excited. But at the end, I was like, okay, audience participation time. What are we going to do in 2024? And I hold the microphone to them, and all 80 people are like, we're going to do big shit. And I'm not afraid of it. And, you know, I don't care about interest rates. I don't care what the Fed says. You know, there's always a deal out there somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
If you're not buying deals, focus on operations. You know, do a better job leasing it. Do a better job at management. Do a better job at investor relations. Do a better job training your talent. So again, if you do what I do and you sit in this chair, there's no snoozing in 24. You know, we're going to roll up our sleeves and, you know, we're going to go to work. And,
you know,
all you real estate brokers out there, that's what y'all do. Y'all know this. I mean, some of the best things that you do happen, you know, in sleepy markets. But this has been a good market, man. This has been a run that I've never encountered before. And I think, you know, part of it is really the pivot of Dallas-Fort Worth to like really an institutionally endorsed market, you know, maybe the best place to put money on an institutional level. And then this kind of industrial real estate, you know, going from being kind of, you know, outhouse to being the darling of, you know, asset types, you know, really has changed the market. So it's been fun. It's been usually in real estate, you can't really trade a market, right? But it's almost like stock. You can trade momentum in a stock, right? If you know Exxon's doing great and it's going up 3 points, it may go up two more points tomorrow. Like it's, and this last 3 years in real estate, you've been able to make, you really, there are a lot of people that could trade momentum. You know, how many guys have you seen that bought something? You're like, man, they paid what for that? They paid up. Well, they pay for that. Well, the pricing went up so fast, it didn't even matter what you paid for it or what your business plan was. It was just worth more. So, you know, everybody had a good run, you know. I call it trading momentum because, you know, the economics, you know, the fundamentals got pretty blurry there at the end, but you can still do it. You can still buy something and sell it for more tomorrow. So, you know, I think that's cooled some now.
It's flattening a little bit.
I think it's flattening, but I don't think we're going to be here super long, to be honest with you.
I think you were just going to see, I mean, I think we're at like 50 million under construction industrial right now.
Yeah.
And that'll probably be the same next quarter, I've heard. But then I bet this time next year, who knows what happens, but I could see that number cutting in half.
I think so.
I'll make a prediction that we're at like closer to 25 than we are to 50 at least.
Yeah.
A year from now. But then the absorptions, I think it'll stay pretty flat and maybe, who knows? I don't think it's going to go away. And will it spike like COVID? Hell, it could, but I would just bet on it staying pretty steady through the year. And then, we're overbuilt right now in certain submarkets for sure. But I think it's going to get absorbed and people are splitting the big buildings. And
yeah,
we were just talking about that.
Yeah, I agree. I think I think we've got a little bit of absorption to do. I think, you know, we've built a development team here and, you know, we're committed to being industrial developers as one of our service offerings. But, you know, it's no fun to go get something to pencil when you're borrowing money at 8 or 8.5 or 9.
Right.
You know, and then you're thinking you're going to sell it on a 5 cap or a 5.25 cap. So what we're doing is we've been really smart about building a land inventory and we're spending the money. We're closing it.
You are closing.
We're closing land like crazy.
I'm getting pretty big discounts actually.
We're getting some really nice positions. And most
because now how many people are out there closing land
well,
right now?
Well, everybody's pencils down, you know. So yeah. I mean we've picked up a lot of tracks from like top 5 developers, like the big institutional REIT guys that, you know, okay, well we're pencils down right now. And that's not well, wait, I got a good deal. That's pencils down on everything. So so we've had our team out there you know, working the phones on the streets, kind of, you know, look, when the industrial world, you want big rectangles on the freeway, right? Yeah. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for big rectangles on the freeway. But we've bought several of those and we're going through, you know, design, entitlements, permitting process. And, you know, when the time's right, we're going to go. I mean, I think, again, we got some absorption that has to happen. You know, I think the Fed's kind of pivoted on interest rates. I think they've messed up a lot more than they know that they've messed up, frankly. So
they're starting to finally realize it.
Yeah.
And, oh, shit, what have we done? And we'll see what happens.
I think so. I mean, if you have a 8% amortizing interest rate, your debt yield's 11 or 12. Well, I mean, guess how many deals work at a 12% debt yield right now that traded or got built in the last 5 years. Guess how many? I mean, almost none.
None.
Right. Yeah. So
I said that after you. I'm just going to let you say the answer to that.
You know, so I hear these guys are like, you know, high interest rates are here to stay. Well, you know, again, I'm a guy from 9 miles down a dirt road, but I will tell you that the sovereign countries in this world are hooked on cheap interest rates. And it's like meth. They can't stay off of it long. And so I am a believer that the super low interest rate environment will return. The question is like how long is it going to take? And you know, I don't think it's going to be super long. I think.
And you're still in Dallas.
And I think 12 months from now, the interest rate environment is going to be, you know, much more normal than it is right now. I do think there's going to be, you know, it's going to be a pretty turbulent year for a transaction volume. But hey, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you can outwork that.
Yeah. I agree. What advice would you give to your younger self?
You know, I would say, be a little bit bolder, quicker, you know, I feel like my ramping up period of my career was kind of like a flat line, you know, and just a little bit every year. And then, you know, when I changed to basically start my own deals, you know, things kind of took off. And, you know, I was pretty young. I was 35, I think, when I took that. But, you know, I wish I'd have been bold enough to do it earlier, you know, because it's been super rewarding.
Did you just wake up one morning? I mean, obviously you're thinking about it for a while and then one day you're just like, okay, let's go.
Yeah. A couple of things, you know, I've got a really good friend, Brad Tidwell, I don't know if you know him. He had been my banker before, and you know, he had left his job as a banker to go do some storage developments. Him and a guy named Cody had bought probably 20 deals together over the years. And, you know, he quit his day job to go be a, you know, a storage developer. And, you know, the Brad and Sharon left to start their deal. And, you know, just kind of like that age where my buddies were like going to do big stuff. And I was like, man, I can do this, you know, and I just kind of had enough, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Transwestern was a great company in a lot of ways, but there was also a, you know, a lot of rules, and, you know, you just, it was kind of like a square peg in a round hole for me. It's like, man, I want to go build something. I want to go buy real estate. I want to do it at a bigger level, you know, and then that necessitated building some companies, you know, and, yeah, so glad I did it. And advice, you know, I would say if I'm talking to young brokers, which at the heart of how we started, we're brokers. So, you know, I think, you know, Billy D said this to me. You remember Bill?
Oh, yeah.
He's like, you know, people hire people on expert knowledge and trust. And, man, one of the things that I feel like I've always done well is I hadn't been really smarter than anybody, but I have tried to be honest. I have tried to treat everybody involved with, you know, mutual respect and dignity. And, you know, and then I look at people and I say, well, I will outwork you. You know, I'm not smarter than you, but I will outwork you. And then, you know, continuity is a big part, kind of my story. You know, the reason most people fail is they don't have a great plan. I don't know that we had a great plan. I think, you know, we're just going to stick with it until it works. It's going to work someday. And, you know, just put my head down and stuck with it, you know, stuck with it as a stub market broker. You know, stuck with it, you know, for 7 years then at Transwestern. And then when I started my own deals, you know, I just stuck with it. And man, it was hard. You know, it's building a company from the ground up, you know, an operating business. It's like, you remember when the Jacksonville Jaguars were an expansion franchise? You know, like,
yeah.
You remember who their quarterback was?
No.
I mean, it was, I don't either, but he wasn't very good.
Yeah.
You know? So when you're trying to get property managers and analysts and, you know, CFOs and project managers, you know, it was hard. You know, getting the right employee mix, getting people that buy into your culture. I mean, we don't have a culture, we're a startup. So, but you know, today we've spent a lot of time knowing kind of who we are, what our core values are, where we're going. I mean, we run a platform called EOS, Executive Operating Systems, and you know, now we're doing 1, 3, 5, 10-year goals. So it's really clear when I talk to my employees, like, hey, y'all want to know where we're going? It's simple. It's right here. Like, you know, we know what we're doing. We know who's doing what part. We know what our plan and our vision is. And, you know, the cool thing about what we do is at the beginning of the year, we're like, man, I know we got a lot of things going on. I know we got a leasing platform. For office, I know we've got asset management, you know, I know we've got construction management, I know we got the fund vehicles, I know we've got analytics, I know we've got accounting, I know we've got development services. I'm like, well, how much, is any of that making any money? You know? So we went on this exercise that Rachel did for us, and I'm like, man, I want to look at everything that we do that's different, that has income or expenses, and I want to look at it and it to have its own P&L, you know, which sounded kind of like minutia, it sound kind of like kind of nerdy, you know, but man, when we looked at it, we're like, good word, man. We make money 19 ways around here, you know, and then your eyes kind of perk up and you're like, okay, who's running property management, for example? And I look at her and I'm like, Kristen, here's your P&L, you know, and then what have I done by doing that? I take that off of me and I'm able to take the business unit leader and say, here's your P&L. What are you going to do with it? You know, and that person will either take ownership and go grow it and build it with you, or you have the wrong person. And, you know, I had that conversation a lot, you know,
like, you have someone responsible for all P&Ls now, or do you,
well,
do you take ownership of any?
Well,
of
no, them? I mean, whoever has, there's a lead of every P&L.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So there's a, you know, our CFO's responsible for the accounting function. And, you know, we charge for accounting for whatever deal or whatever investment vehicle that we have. You know, same thing with office leasing, same thing with, you know, fundraising, same thing with analytics. So yeah, it was actually really exciting.
How'd you come up with that idea?
Well, let me also say this. I don't do what I do to make money. You know, it's great to make money. We do make money, but, I do it because I freaking love it.
No doubt.
You know, like,
that's clear.
My mom often asks me, she's like, I thought you were going to retire. I'm like, man, what would I do? You know, I've got a lot of hobbies, but I love, you know, I've got the need for deals in my veins. You know, you want to see me get super happy? We just put a piece of land under contract. Guy calls, and he'd been offering it to us for $5 million. It's like, man, I just can't do that. I can't do it. I'm not feeling it. It's not a good time to be buying land unless you're getting a great price. Well, they called me 2 weeks ago and like, what would you do? What would you pay in 10 days? I'm like, huh, let me think about that. So, I mean, I offered them $1 million in 10 days and I wound up doing it at $1,150,000. They're asking $5 million, you know, 6 months ago. Yeah. So, and that was the happiest I've been all week. I'm like, man, you know, yeah, I'm going to do that. That's going to work.
Yes.
You know? So, you know, still got the instinct for deals in my veins. I think, you know, it's been one of the hardest things we've done, but we've built a really talented, talented team, you know, of guys that know how to go. You know, getting people to know how to pick deals is super hard. Because to be a good real estate guy, what do you have to do? You got to be part lawyer, part salesman, part environmental scientist, part structural engineer, you know, part finance guy. I mean, the list goes on, right? There's yeah. There's no magic formula to how do you become a part artist, you know?
Yeah, did you say sales?
So there's so many things that you really have to know something about. Part banker, I mean.
It's funny, so many businesses, a lot of my clients' businesses, you see they have like the business development group and the operations group and the finance group and all that. And when you are in real estate, it's like you got to really wear all hats to be a dangerous real estate professional, in my opinion. You know, yeah. You got to be able to do the operations. You got to be able to do the sales, really. That's all business is, those two things, marketing.
Yeah. And that's why it's so hard to teach, right? And because
yeah.
there's so many different facets.
And then manage the team once you start building it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's been different for me, you know, leading this team. And it's also been super cool. But, you know, my guys, you know, you really don't have a business if you're the one doing it until your team, until you can remove yourself from the team and those guys function, you don't have a very good company. And it's certainly not worth very much, right? So, you know, I went to Africa back in October. One of my business partners, he's got a show called Getaway to Africa on the Sportsman Channel. He's like, hey, I got a hippo that somebody needs to kill and I can't do it, you know? He's like, no, it's dangerous. It's a dangerous hunt. Do you want to go for me? I'm like, yeah, man, I'm your guy. You know, I'm going to go to Africa and shoot this hippo for you, you know? So I started thinking about that. Now, you know, like 500 people a year get killed by a hippo. So I started thinking about it around here and I'm like, what happens if I'm the guy, like one of the 500 that gets run over by the hippo? So anyway, I announced this policy. We talk about it. We're like, yeah, let's have a hippo policy. Let's know what happens if Clint gets eaten by a hippo in Africa. Let's know if our analyst gets...
Is that what they eat you?
Well, they run you over. Well, yeah, they'll run you over or trample you or whatever. But
yeah,
they are pretty dangerous. But anyway,
hippo policy.
Hippo policy, yeah. So what happens? If your analyst leaves and never comes back, what do you do? If your CFO leaves and comes back, what do you do? So anyway, so it kind of popped up. Like, hey, it'd be good to know. Because we're big, you know, we've got probably 40 people now. So, you know, there were so many times in the course of our business where, hey, if that person leaves, like we're toast, you know? Yeah. So anyway, just we looked at that, like, okay, what's our policy? What's our plan? You know, if something happens to Ward, what is your team gonna do?
Yeah.
You know, so you know, that's one of the things that we've done. And anyway, it's been a fun run. Got great relationships in the brokerage community and we've got a lot of good investors. You know, we've done 3 fund vehicles, you know, and we capitalize. You know, we have flexibility. We capitalize our deals, you know, any number of ways. Sometimes we do it with our own money, a lot of it. Sometimes we raise, you know, kind of LP money. Sometimes we do it. It's just depending on the deal, you know. So the cool thing is we do, you know, we do multiple product types. We're actually one of the weirdos that are still buying a little bit of office, you know.
I raised my eyebrows when you bought an office building with the fund.
I know, but I mean, are you going to an office?
No,
not at all.
People do at my company, but I personally do not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we come here every day.
Yeah.
You know, and our people like to come here. I like to come here. And, I mean, for the most part, I mean, we're seeing most people back in the office, maybe not 5 days a week, but certainly 3 to 4 days a week.
I never went to the office, though. You know me.
Yeah, that's right. You're not a good example.
I was working from home and remote like way before COVID ever happened. So
yeah,
I think people go back to certain offices.
Agreed. So. I think if you're, you know, if you have the amenities in your Class A building, you know, if you're enriched in your top 4 or 5 building, you know, you're going to lease space. If you're in Park Central and you're top 3 or 4 building, you're going to lease space. If you're in North Tollway and you're the top 5 or 10 buildings, you're going to lease space.
Yeah.
But, you know, and we've done B, but the B is going to have our time. You know, a lot of that's, you know, probably going to be multifamily or, you know, different uses. You know, it's interesting to see, you know, 20-year-old office being torn down for industrial in Freeport. You know,
it happens all over LA right now. I mean, that's the whole business that just happened all through COVID, just knocking down those office buildings.
Yeah. So I think we'll see a lot of that. But, I mean, we're still believers. I mean, probably the only positive leverage trade you can do right now is office. I mean, we have a deal we're about to do that's, you know, an 11.5 cap, 80% leased,
yeah,
and with a pretty tight WALT.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I get dead at 8, you know, I'm still...
You're rocking.
350 basis points positive leverage. But, you know, you can't do that on multi right now. You can't do it on industrial right now.
Right.
You know, you can't get a development loan. So, I mean... Clearly, you can't buy anything you don't think you can lease. So if you don't think you can lease it, doesn't matter what the basis is. You know, in industrial, there's some price where there's always somebody to take you out, and that's not true on office. If you buy office that you can't lease, there may not be anybody behind you. So
yeah. So
you got to be careful and be sure the product is, you know, has a place in the market. So
I have a question. You may have already addressed it, but what's the greatest obstacle that you've ever overcome along the way?
Greatest obstacle.
In life or business.
Yeah. You know, my wife says I'm pretty hard headed, you know, and I think that's probably true. So my trainer used to ask me, man, buddy, what's the hardest thing you've ever done? And I didn't take very much time at all and said, man, it's being married, you know?
Yeah.
Cause I mean, I love my wife. She's great. Our marriage is good. We're great. But it's hard, you know?
It's work.
Like that person looks at you and
it's
like...
It's good because you work at it.
Right? Yeah, you have to work. If you're not focused on it, just like real estate, if you're not focused on it and you're not investing in it, guess what? So, man, you've constantly got to be investing, making those deposits in trust, love, affection, you know, all those ways. And she wants to be your person, you know? So if you're not treating her like she's your person, then you're going to start having problems. So, you know, being married...
Wise words.
Yeah, being married is one of the hard things, you know? You know, having business partners, they, you know, I'll see it one way sometimes, they see it another way. I'm pretty convicted that I'm right. They're pretty convicted they're right. So, you know, it's imperfect, but, you know, if you have a partner that wants, at the end of the day, wants to do the right thing for the deal or wants to do the right thing for the business, then you can usually...
They should listen to you.
Usually address that. I think one of the other things that's challenging is, you know, I love people.
Yeah.
So when we have to... I mean, make no mistake, we're not trying to build ordinary companies. I mean, we're trying to build, you know, best-in-class business. And, you know, we have to let go of some people. So we have some turnover. And, you know, that's always hard, you know, because they may be really great people and they also may be really good at their craft. They're just not the right fit culturally. Or oftentimes, we have them in the wrong seat, you know. We got them doing this and they really ought to be doing that. So, you know, making really good hires, and then also acting quick when you realize, hey, that's not my person. It's better for them, and it's better for me. I mean, we've been through, you know, several partner buyouts. So those are hard. You know, like love. The, you know, we've had some guys that we partner in business with that we're friends with, and man, I've had to sit down and look at those guys and say, man, I love you like a brother, but you know, we think this thing's got to go left, and you know, you don't believe in that. So those have been hard. You know, we wrote some checks.
What a weight off your shoulders when you have that conversation though, right?
That
tense moments leading up to it. And then, once it's done, at least maybe not instantaneously, but pretty quickly, everybody recognizes this was for the best.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So those things are hard. You know, the people element, you know, look, when I was just brokering deals or investing in deals, just me, I don't have to deal, you know, dealing with clients a little bit, investors a little bit, but now, you know, I do deal with a lot of people issues and people are tough, and man, I'm a believer in people. I want to believe every person wants what's good for us and wants to do a great job. And that's mostly true, but it's not always,
yeah.
You know? So, I mean, we're looking for, you know, really talented people that want to help us build something great. And yeah, that's kind of what we're doing. And, you know, this story isn't my story. You know, this is a God story. You know, God, this wouldn't have been possible. You know, you can't go from 9 miles across. I was cross-eyed until I was 14. You can't go from living 9 miles down a dirt road, picked on in school because you're cross-eyed, to Sam Houston State University to, you know, running a private equity company in Dallas without, you know, kind of God having a plan and trying to be obedient to that and be a good steward of whether he's giving me a little or giving me a lot. You know, I want to be obedient with that. And, you know, that's a big charge. And it's a big responsibility, but I don't, you know, it doesn't weigh on me because independent of what happens, you know, I know this is his plan and, you know, I can be obedient to that.
My next question is, have you ever had a mystical experience? And I would also just touch on what you just said, like how long has that relationship with God and the faith in God been there?
Yeah. You know, I found Jesus when I was, maybe 11 or 12 years old. You know, I had this moment where, you know, my stepdad and my mom had been, you know, my mom and dad got divorced when I was 7. So I learned pretty early that, hey, everything's not perfect. There's more going on here. And, you know, I was raised in a small town and in a small church. And, you know, I gave my life to the Lord. I didn't really know exactly what that meant, but I do believe somebody created us. We didn't get here by accident. It's like,
100%.
I mean, what are the odds of this iPhone got here without anybody? This isn't an accident, buddy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not, you can make a human fingernail by accident. Like we're not here by accident, right? So, you know, when you start thinking a little bit, you're like, man, somebody made us and got us here. Man, I just had that conviction and calling on my life. Like, man, you know, there's no way for me to do it without, you know, knowing, having a relationship with who created me and knowing what his provision is for me. And, you know, I accepted that, you know, at a young age and, you know, went through high school, you know, drinking beer, doing pastor parties, but, you know, I was still convicted about that. And, but, you know, when I was probably, 30, you know, I started getting, you know, a little bit more mature in my faith. I mean, my wife and I were super different. Like she's a, you know, Catholic from California, and I was a Southern Baptist from East Texas. So like we're polar opposites, right? So when we got married, I was like, man, we're not going to make it if we don't like find a place to serve God and worship together. So anyway, we found a church like the first week after we married and just really plugged in and built friends and accountability partners. And, you know, we're just, you know, learn to invest in our faith together.
Yeah.
But, you know, then when I was probably, you know, 33 or 34, you know, about the time that I started, you know, we started these businesses, managed to have my moment in my closet. It wasn't really a pressure or stress thing, but I just had this moment, you know, in my closet where I like knew something big was about to happen. You know, you ever felt that?
Yeah.
And man, I remember just getting on my knees and, you know, just crying and praying to God and like, man, hey, I know you're up to something big. I don't want to mess it up. I want to pay attention. You know, I don't know what you're doing here, but I want to give you the honor and glory and I want to do it for you. And man, from that moment forward, I do feel, you know, the most important thing we do is, you know, love others well and, try to point them to Christ, I believe.
Amen, brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I've been going through that this year.
Yeah.
And
it is
when you start feeling that, that's why I added this question on. You're one of the, I think you're the second person I've asked it to.
It's okay.
The last person I asked it to said that he renounced God last year.
Oh, no.
Like, oh shit. You know, I was like, yeah, you'll come back around, I'm sure.
Well, let's hope.
But man, I feel what you mean with that, everything you're talking about. And thanks for sharing that. It is so important. And man, it just, for me, it's helped me so much through tough times, always all through my life. And I've seen all kinds of little signs here and there, but yeah, that energy you're talking about, like, I feel like that's happened now. I feel like it could be a worldwide thing going on right now too. And there's shifts happening.
Yep. So, about 4 or 5 years ago, I went through this shortly after we started the companies. I went through this run where I had I lost all four grandparents.
Yeah.
You know, they were in their 80s, but I lost all four of them in like 18 months. You know,
Wow.
One of them had a stroke and died. One of them had cancer. You know, the other one, just died unexpectedly. And so that kind of shook me up. And then I had a buddy, a buddy that fell over dead at 47. Really, really good friend. And then I had a brother take his life. You know, so I went through this like period of a couple of years where it was just really, really heavy. And, life is short, we need to treasure each day, with our family, with our kids, with our business. And I mean, it also just challenged me to like, none of us are getting it out of here alive. Like, man, the day to be, serious about your faith is now, like I just buried 7 people. And, anyway, it's just a strange thing to happen to me, and I don't know why it happened. It happened at that time, but that was kind of a heavy time, and
that was leading up to this moment that you're speaking about when you were in the closet.
No, that was actually probably before that, but yeah. It's hard to lose a lot of family, and it's just a continual reminder. Like, man, you can't take a bunch of money and a bunch of real estate with you,
Yeah.
So you can't put all your time and treasure in. Storing up money and putting hay in the barn, or too many deals. I mean, it's got to be what we do, not who we are.
It's really helped me. I've like with my sobriety is leaning on Jesus. Read a book and it refers to Jesus as Yeshua, which was his name that he went by. Back then, supposedly, like that's what they called him, Yeshua, or some pronunciation of that.
Yeah.
So. In my head, I get little voices and they're like, maybe it's okay to have a drink, whatever. And then I just like picture Yeshua and you can think of him. He's depicted so often in the church, which in a way that for just someone walking by, it looks pretty sad. And like, he's hanging on a cross and tears coming out of his eyes and all of this. But you got to remember like this guy, when he walked into a room, people would say he cast demons away, but they ran away. They were like, get the fuck out of here. Cause Yeshua was walking in the room. And then he like walked into the temple. There's that part in the Bible and they're like making money in there or something. And he's like, get out of my father's house. So I always play, I think of him as like this warrior, like this badass, like just ultimate warrior who then died on the cross by choice, basically to go save everyone.
Yeah.
But because he's a warrior again, but thinking of that warrior walking into the temple. So whenever the little voices in my head try to get me to drink, I call on him. I say, Yeshua, get my back. And then I say, get out of my father's house. I might drop a little motherfucker in there too. And I don't think he minds. Having him with me, it just brings me so much ease and so much comfort and strength that is just irreplaceable.
That's awesome. Alcohol is tough, man. I don't really have an addictive personality, but, last year I did a dry first quarter, cause man, we go starting in November, we have dove season, deer hunting trips, Christmas parties, client dinners, client functions, Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving.
Oh yeah.
And then at the end, I'm like, man, that was a lot, So, I did the first quarter, didn't drink at all. And, I'm glad I did that. And I'm probably going to do it again. My dad is struggling with cancer. That's pretty serious. I don't think they can do a lot more for him. I just also feel called to like a season of like, kind of clarity, if I'm 10% better dad or 20% better business guy or 20% better friend because I'm not having a drink or two here and there, what's more valuable? I think being the best that I can be and you being the best you can be, for the people that count on you and the people that you love is important. So
I agree. And that's how I'm living right now. I know better than to go talk about what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, but today that's where I'm at. And yeah, that clarity. And hey, it becomes for me like its own high. And I've now have so much, I mean, I've drank a couple times in the last 8 years, you know, like I've had a couple stints, short stints. And now like the last time that I drank, I don't feel comfortable drinking anymore. Like it used to be fun and it used to be relaxing, but now I'm so wired into not drinking that lack of clarity that I get when I do drink, it's just not, it's not the same. And it gives me like, I feel the anxiety, but I drank for so long, like since I got into college or whatever, then that's how I dealt with like whatever anxiety I felt, but then it compounded it so much. But now that I'm removed from it, it's like, oh, it's actually, I feel that it causes anxiety where it used to always feel like the anxiety reliever. But thankfully, I feel like I've rewired to a degree where the more I've done it lately, you know, like then I don't like it anymore. And that's good. But it's all because it's high just to be alive, right? Like Go be sober and then feel these emotions of whatever they are. The anxiety is going to be less. The depression is going to be less. I'm going to be able to zap it out faster than the other way around. And then that's my game, is just like get through all of that and then navigate it. Identify what is that I'm feeling? Why is that? Is it because I didn't get sleep? It's because I ate shitty food? Because I didn't work out? Those are normally the things. Or somebody's bothering me? Then just be conscious about it and then like work through that and resolve it. It's like, it becomes like a video game basically. And it's pretty fun and catching yourself. And it's not going to be easy. It's always going to be hard at times. And then you navigate through it and you just have your moments. Like you got to deal with both sides, right? It's life.
Yeah, man. Life is good and beautiful. And you know, hopefully you can get to a point of maturity where we don't need a substance to like tell us that,
yeah,
you know,
but you wouldn't know if it was good and beautiful if it wasn't dark and tough at times.
Yeah.
And
true.
That's, you wouldn't know the difference. And that's the beauty of it. So, I'm going to hit you through my quick round of questions so you can drop some knowledge and advice for people.
Okay.
First one, I asked, what's your favorite hotel? And I think I'm going to change this because I'm moving away from hotels and I like Airbnbs more, but what's your favorite vacation destination, should I say?
You know, I'm going with the Virgin Islands. We went with some friends on a catamaran to the British Virgin Islands 2 summers ago. Man, that was awesome.
Stayed
on the catamaran.
Oh, very cool.
For a week. And man, that was awesome.
How many couples?
Just 2 couples.
Okay.
We could fit. I think we could have had a couple more couples.
Yeah.
But you know, being on a boat with, you got to be sure you know who you're going to be on a boat.
No,
be on a boat with. You know, I love you. We may not be able to spend seven days on a boat together. Yeah. We probably would, but you know, and so yeah, that was super cool, man. That's just one of the most beautiful places on earth. Cool thing about the boat is you just move. You know, if you like, you stay one night here, you go to another island and stay night there, and you go on shore and have dinner and drinks or whatever you're going to do, sit on the beach and you pop back on. So, you know, that's super cool. And I'm also,
where do you go to the bathroom? You just do it right in the ocean?
Well, that's always an option, but you know, they do have bathrooms on the boat. I mean, they're like 60-foot boats. You know, I also love the mountains. So I love to go to Colorado and snow ski and do that.
What mountain?
You know, I like Durango. I like Winter Park. You know, like Telluride. I mean, I like them all.
Yeah.
You know, so I've been doing a lot up there. We go trail riding with some friends in the summer.
Yeah.
You know, take our boys up there and take us side by side and just, you know, do that. Let the kids go wild and do 100 miles a day of mountain trails. So that's fun. And
do your kids work, by the way?
Well, my oldest is 15, but he actually worked this summer with Chase Miller.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, you're getting him started.
Started early, but he's an entrepreneurial little guy.
He's 15 working for Chase Miller.
15. He's like, Dad, I need to do something this summer. And you know, Chase and I are really good friends.
You need to get him to you need to help me get him on the podcast.
He'll do it. Yeah. I told him I was coming on, and he said, "Well, tell Ward I'm up next." So,
oh, really?
So yeah, I think he's,
love that.
I think he's up. So
he interviewed with me.
Did he?
Yeah. I would love to say I should have hired him, but he did exactly what he should have done.
Well, I don't really know how to explain the phenomenon that is Chase Miller. You know,
I know Mark Miller's son.
Well, and Mark's
the genetics of that family.
Mark, I love Mark. Mark's one of the nicest guys, probably one of the best brokers. I know he's one of the best brokers in town, but Chase does it a completely different
way. Yeah, by the way, just to correct what I'm saying he's not successful because, I mean, I'm saying maybe the genetics have something, but yeah. There was no nepotism involved. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Chase is, it's just been amazing to watch what he's done.
He's the most relentless. I mean, like I told you, I put down my brokerage business for the most part alone. No, people still call me and I'd refer it to guys that I know, you know, hey, take care of this person. They're good for, you know, send me a 10% referral or something or not. Just take care of them, you know? Yeah. And so he called me. He might've called me 10 times in a day. And I'm like, man, who is this person that's blowing me up? And, you know, finally answered the phone and I'm like, golly, this kid's tenacious. And actually the seller kept telling him like, hey, I'm never doing anything unless Clint endorses that. And, yeah. And I hadn't even talked to this guy in 10 years. So anyway, we don't do the deal. And then he called me and he's like, hey, I got a deal. Would you buy it? Like, this kid doesn't, you know, that's what I do for a living. I buy deals. So anyway, he talked me into buying this deal. And so I bought it and, you know, the rest is history. I mean, he sells me a bunch of deals. And of course, he sells everybody a bunch of deals, you know?
Yeah, he does.
That's one thing he's been able to crack, you know? Like usually if you're a submarket guy, you got a couple of go-to guys, but you know, he's been able to, you know, do business with kind of everybody and, you know, to really do what Jeff was doing in the early 2000s, you know, yeah. He's been able to go, you know, take a market and do it really, really well, really, really quick.
Very
quick. I mean, so anyway, the tenacity and the work ethic and.
We got to get him on. Trucking on.
Yeah.
He needs to be here. So what's your favorite restaurant? If you're going to go take Ashley out for a nice dinner.
You know, I'm like a steak and seafood guy.
Oh yeah.
So
me too, brother.
I'll do seafood, anywhere you can get it. I'll have a dozen raw oysters and then I'll, you know, chase it down with a fillet or sea bass or crab legs, any of that. So anything steak and seafood. I don't have a specific place that's my favorite because I'm pretty flexible, but yeah, steak, seafood for that.
Yeah. What about a book that you would recommend?
You know, I can't even find it, but have you read Master Builder, the Trammell Crow biography? Man, I think that one, if you want to be a Dallas real estate guy and you need to read one book, it's got to be that one, you
it's
know,
because
the history of Helm and, you know, Stemmons and...
He's building the first warehouses in Dallas.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all started right here, you know, for the most part. And, you know, that's just, that's a fascinating book. You know, The Big Rich about the Dallas, you know, oil and gas families.
Love that book.
You know, is an awesome book. I'm trying to think. Empire of the Summer Moon. Have you ever read that?
No, I have not.
That's one that I like. I go to sleep in like 1 minute, so I like to read, but I don't get to read a lot because, you know, I'll go to bed and, you know, by the time I hit the bed at 10:30, I'm toast, man. I'm trying, all right, I'm going to read a chapter. I'll read two paragraphs. And
I just listen to books now when I drive around. That's one of my moves.
And I'm out, but, and I do that too, but Empire of the Summer Moon, what we forget is that the Comanches had everything west of Fort Worth till the 1880s.
Wow.
So, man, you go west of Fort Worth, you know, settlers are getting, you know, raped and killed and shot with arrows. And anyway, it's just a fascinating piece of Texas history. You know,
I got to read that.
Like the frontier was like anything west of Fort Worth. And man, you're probably not going to make it, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's my family was from, you know, out west Texas, or at least my grandfather's family was kind of from Woodson, Throckmorton area. So, that was a fascinating read. You know, spiritual books. I read a ton of Tim Keller books. You know, I really like what he writes.
Yeah. You only get to pick one.
Chuck Swindoll. Oh, well, okay. I'll just ramble. If I'm rambling on you, I'm sorry.
That's my job, is to control the conversation.
Yeah.
But no, that's a lot of great book recommendations. I think we go with Master Builder by Trammell Crow, though.
I agree.
That was your first one.
I don't even know where you buy it anymore. Yeah. I tried to buy it, and I can't even find it. I tried to buy it to give copies to my guys. And
I have it. I have a copy. I probably got it like 10 years. I got it after his funeral, so man, that was probably like 15 years ago or something.
Yeah, but what a great...
he went to Woodrow, where I went to high school.
Really?
And actually, I should plug this, because I'm going to need to hit up the audience to help with this, but I just started the Trammell Crow Scholarship Fund at Woodrow.
Really?
Yep. So we're going to do our first scholarship this year to help an entrepreneurial type student get some money to go to college. Doesn't have money.
Man, it's so cool.
I'm looking forward to it. So yeah, George Billingsley was a guest on here, and that was really interesting to hear him. I'm going to have to get him back on, but being the grandson of Trammell Crow and just growing up with all that.
Man, for sure.
Like that pedigree, and Lucy, his mom, you know, she's just a machine.
For sure.
What about a quote?
You know, I just think, when I talk to you about continuity, you know, just, and then just be the same person, you know, be the same guy you are at work, be the same guy at home.
Yes.
Just, you know, be authentic in who you are.
Yeah.
You know, don't be a different guy at work and a different guy when you're without your wife, when you are, you know, just, you know, be the same person, you know, that way when you look yourself in your mirror, you know who you are and you don't get confused.
That's right.
You know, it was a long time ago, you know, and with 15-year-olds, I kind of deal with this phone, but man, a long time ago, I told my wife and kids, you know, I connected my phone to my kid's iPad, you know? So, hey, you don't have to worry about what I'm doing. Like I'm living 100% transparent life. You want to get on my phone? You want to see who's texting me? You want to read my email? You want to know what I'm doing on social media? Guess what? That takes temptation to hide, or like get involved in some kind of relationship that you shouldn't be, or to look at content that you shouldn't. Guess what? By one simple life change, I've taken really the risk of me doing any of that off the table.
Yeah.
Not entirely, but
you can't control what your friend texts you.
Yeah. So, sometimes that one gets me a little bit.
But I'm the same way. The iPad they use, my texts go to it. And there was a time when I did not put such a high value on the truth. And you know what it did? It caused me anxiety. And typically I would drink to deal with it. And when getting sober, that's a big thing. Like I don't want to have anxiety. So how do you get rid of shame? You tell the absolute truth. And if you have absolute truth, then you have no shame. It's pretty tough when you're just open about everything. And that's the way to live.
Yeah, man. The gospel message is simple. If you're a believer, I mean, just get on your knees and ask for forgiveness, and man, he'll cast it as far as the east is from the west, and you know, go put that behind you.
But what about the truth will set you free? That's true too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not saying just ask for forgiveness from Jesus. I think maybe that might work in a mystical manner, and you can be forgiven. I don't know about that. You can have faith in that, but I do that. But I also believe, like, telling the truth, period, that's going to set me free right here, right now. And it's the way to be. And
well, then you don't have to deal with, you know, if you're honest, or you're always kind of transparent, if you mess up, you can just quickly say, you know what, I'm sorry, move on. But if you're not honest, you're not transparent, then you have to deal with the consequences of this web of deceit, right? And that can cause depression on you in a second, you know?
Yeah.
And that's happened to all of us at some points in our life.
No doubt. Yeah, and it'll still happen at times, right? Like, I'm not some perfect truth teller all the time. Like, I might say something, but I'm pretty quick to feel it now, very sensitive to it, and then go, hey, I said that just to be clear, this is what I meant. I'm almost over the top, but it works for me. That's so true, man. And just being that same person. I struggled with that a lot, because I was like, Rockstar Award. And
yeah, like there's three or four different awards.
There are.
And that's awesome that you could pull it off.
Well, but the thing is, I used to keep them separated, and that caused me a lot of stress. Because I was wearing different faces and different hats, and I dressed different ways, and I I behaved different way and meant different manners. And I was living all these separate lives, not like in a bad way necessarily. I mean, there were some of the things that were bad, I guess, but in general, it was just like, I had a bunch of different interests and I had shame about some of my interests around some of my other interests. And now finally, as a 45-year-old man, because I'm a dad basically, and I don't give a fuck about what people think about me anymore, like I once did, I just can wear all hats and I can just, hey, I'm just me. And this podcast is actually a great little method for me to do that, because I can talk about all the different things I'm into and just be myself, you know, and it feels great.
Man,
what God put us here to do is be ourselves, to be original. I think originality lacks a lot in the world right now. And that's what my spiritual teacher tells me. And it's like, yeah, everybody is a unique individual and you should shine that light. And just even if it feels, it's of course going to feel uncomfortable if you're doing something a little different, but once you show the world, guess what? Immediately you zap that shame with the truth. And that's the answer.
Man, it's too much pressure to live for what people think. You know, think about the weight. If you worry about what everybody thinks all the time, you know, some of my partners ask me, like, man, does that bother you? And like, man, no, not really. And it's not that I don't care what people think, but you know, I grew up cross-eyed until I was 14 years old. So there's nothing you could say about me that hadn't already been said, you know? So, you know, I think fortunately for me, I never got in a place where I was too vulnerable. I mean, I knew what I had a plan. I was sticking with it. I knew I was trying to, you know, do my best to be good stewards of relationships or clients. And, you know, I never got caught up in like living for, you know, image or because somebody, guess what? Somebody's always going to outdo you. Somebody's always going to be prettier than you. Somebody's always going to have a more expensive car than you. Somebody's always going to be a better broker than you.
Good job finding God when you're 11 years old.
Somebody's going to have a better company than you. So it's just too much weight, man. If you can just be authentic and know who you're living for and, kind of rinse and repeat. And
like you said about work, it's not set to create these separate things like work-life balance. I talked about this on the last podcast I just recorded. You can't look at it like work-life balance, because then you can be like, well, work's not a part of my life, so that's just separate. But no, work is a part of, it's a very important part of everyone's life. And so if it's as important as all the other things, which to a certain degree it needs to be because of how much time we've been doing this and how it supports everything else that we do, basically from a financial perspective, but not only that, just like emotionally, like how much time we're spending, you got to treat it like this is a significant portion of my life. So if you're doing something that does not allow you to perform in an authentic manner and you're working out of a sense of obligation more so than authenticity, then you know what you're going to do is you're going to be miserable. And you got to go be able to be self-aware enough to be like, hey, I'm here to do this and go do that thing. And that's different for everybody.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, really successful people do it because that's what they love, not to make money. Making money is a byproduct of doing, of being something that you love and building something that you love.
That's right. What about a song? What song should our listeners listen to?
Song. I'm a Neil Diamond guy. I've been to 4 Neil Diamond concerts. Okay. I also love...
Did you go to the New York City show at all? I heard he was doing all these New York shows.
I did not. But man, I love Neil Diamond. I also love, you know, country music. Old-time country.
What's your Neil Diamond song?
You know, song. Sweet Caroline, Forever in Blue Jeans.
Yeah.
He's got a ton. You know, I could listen to... You know, when Ash and I first started dating, you know, she'd sit in a recliner with me and I could sing a whole album. My voice isn't very good, but I could sing a whole album of Neil Diamond and just sing along with the whole, the whole track.
Love
so
that. You and I did a country road trip years ago.
We did.
Down to Shiner, Texas.
We did.
Where we went.
We did.
We had a Shiner and, that was fun. We stayed at my cousin's house.
We did.
He had a kegerator.
We should do it again.
We should. Let's go. I need to make some cold calls and set a meeting for us. Go find a building to buy.
Oh, that's funny.
What about a charity or cause that you're passionate about?
You know, that's a good question. We actually have a charity here we call 5 and 2.
Okay.
And kind of the genesis of that is, you know, when Jesus feeds the 5,000, What's he do that with? He does it with, you know, 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. So, you know, like I told you, it's about more than us. It's about, you know, kind of being hands and feet for God's calling and purpose. So we, you know, we founded Five and Two several years ago, actually. So we donate a percentage of our profits to that. And really, we want it to be bigger than us. And we were about to go, you know, have some fundraisers and try to get some other guys on board. And, you know, then COVID happened and it got hard to have events. So, you know, we have a couple of people donated to that, but, you know, we're hoping to kind of ramp that up. We almost hired some senior leadership, you know, for that to like get it to kind of spreads at Wings of Fly.
Executive director.
Yeah. But, you know, that we think there's an awesome ministry there. I mean, it's, you know, really just to kind of meet the need, you know, that we think Christ would want met. And it kind of fits that gap between, you know, a little more than your kind of church benevolence fund. And, you know, so if it's more than that, and maybe there's not another place that it fits. For example, we donated some money to some missionaries and, you know, I think South Africa, and, you know, they're like, man, we can open 17 churches if we had like this amount of money. And, you know, we'd have solar lights and we'd have a canopy roof. And, like, we're your guys for that. You know, we've had people call like, man, you know, my brother died unexpectedly and we can't cover the funeral costs. So we've done stuff like that. But so there's not a lot of limits on what we want to help. You know, we want to help people with that. Yeah. So, I'm passionate about it. You know, I kind of wish that was my full-time day job, but you know, it's not. And, you know, that kind of gets stuck in the background of my day job. But, you know, we think there's a beautiful calling there.
Yeah.
You know, at the simplistic message of, you know, give money, you know, tithe to your local church, but also, you know, give some of your resources to an organization that wants to just do, you know, meet the needs of the church either can't meet financially or it's a little bit too big, or so we kind of love that. Yeah. That platform, and it's something that we've been working on for some years, and we still got some work to do. But
do you have a website for it?
Yeah, I think it's 5and2.com or 5and2.org.
Okay. I think Brant talked about it too, so we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, so that's great. That's something we need to kind of get out there to the world.
If you had $100 million in your briefcase, what one thing would you invest it in? One asset class, if you're thinking real estate, which I'm sure you are.
Real estate. Man, our land business, you know, is an awesome place.
I love that play that you're doing, that you're piling up land right now and then you're just waiting and then you're going to pounce.
You know, we bought
land. Such great strategy. Rectangles on the highway. That's the quote of the podcast.
Pretty simple. Pretty simple concept. You know, I call it. One of my guys was starting an entity and he's like, well, what do you want to call it? And he put like 6301 Highway 80 or whatever. And I was like, well, why don't we call it BAIR Holdings? And he's like, what the heck is that? And I'm like, big ass industrial rectangle. You know?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen any guy build on a circle? You know?
I love acronyms for names, by the way. Do you know, I have two businesses, like my brokerage business is TCB PDQ, taking care of business pretty dang quick.
Yeah.
And then the investment business, TBTFW.
So rectangles on the freeway, you know, when industrial rents started growing, you know, industrial prices went, industrial buildings were 50, 60 bucks a foot. And then they went to what?
150.
50, 60 bucks a foot, 80, 100, 150.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened overnight. You know, it happened
We were sitting there together like watching what is going on.
My investors were like, well, let's buy industrial. And I'm like, man, I'd love to. I just don't know how to buy 4 caps. I don't know how to, under the private equity model, I don't know how to return enough yield to get people to
want
to do it.
I remember when you guys started, you were saying that. You were buying a whole office at first.
Yeah. So when that started happening in industrial, I'm like, man, what can we do? And then I thought, you know, what is the land market doing? And there was still stuff getting listed for $2 and $3 a foot. I told my guys, I'm like, man, let's go buy land. Because if rents go up, industrial buildings are trading for 150s, 170s a foot. Like, land has to follow. So we started, you know, started buying some, started looking, started figuring out what we wanted to do. But, you know, we've bought pieces for $2 a foot and sold them for 10.
Yeah.
You know, we bought pieces for $1 a foot and sold them for 7. You know, so you start doing the math on that and
Big math.
It's not a 15 IRR and a 1.75X.
You don't need a finance degree to figure that out.
No, that's working. You know, you also have to carry it. You can't get a lot of leverage on it. You know, it's a long game, so don't buy it if you think you're going to own it 6 months. Buy it as if you're going to own it for 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately for us, about half what we buy is zoned industrial and probably development ready or pretty close to being development ready.
Yeah.
So some of it we're gonna build on. I mean, I think our 3 year goal is to build, you know, another 1 million feet of industrial. You know, some of that's dependent on construction prices coming in and interest rates kind of normalizing. But so some of that land we're gonna build on, and you know, some of it we get phone calls like, hey, if we want to buy that, and some of it we've sold and made nice yields on.
It makes sense.
So yeah, man, if I had $100 million and you said, man, you need to put this in an asset class, you know, I'm a diversity guy, so I'd go buy 3 or 4 really good industrial land parcels in the Metroplex. You know, I'd probably, we're probably going to raise a self-storage fund. Some of our partners, you know, had a big exit a couple years ago, and they've got 5 storage deals we're going to do. So I'd probably put, you know, 5 or 10 million of that in the storage fund. You know, like I said, we're about to buy 11.5 cap office deal that's 20 years old, built by Trammell Crow. It's going to be an insane deal. It's 100% going to work, you know? So I'd put some money in that. I find stuff, you know, we don't really
put it in Clint Riley approved deals.
I'd put it Clint Riley endorsed deals. We have deal meeting.
All Dallas? No, you're going to six states, you said.
Most of what we do is in Dallas, but I mean, we do some build to suits. I mean, if you call us with your national tenant rep client, like, dude, I got to be in Birmingham, Alabama, bad. I'll go do it for you.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, we've done California, Ohio, Arkansas.
What's your value proposition to go build in Alabama versus like a household name developer?
I make it super easy for them.
Yeah.
You know, and I deliver, right? So
yeah.
I'll usually use their board form lease. And they'll call me and tell me. And I know they're real. Like, and several of these people that I've done it with, I've done it over and over. But, man, I just do what I say I'm going to do. I come through for them. I make a fair deal with them. You know, I don't go and get in a six-month lease negotiation. You know, I get there quick. And then I handle it all. I go find the land. I'm like, you know, I like rectangles with frontage. So if I go to Birmingham or I go some other place, I'll go pay more for the land to get a good rectangle on the freeway, you know. And, you know.
How do you find contractors out there to go build?
That's tough. That's the hardest part of it.
I figured it would be.
You know, we have our own construction business, so sometimes we'll send a superintendent, one of our guys out there.
Just to oversee.
Sometimes we'll send one of our building erectors from here. Yeah. So it's kind of a mixed bag. Some we like to use as many local trades as we can.
Yeah.
But you know, that's also the pain point on most of these projects.
Yeah.
You know, it's been fun. It's been fun to learn to build in different cities. We built one in Sacramento, California, which that was an interesting phenomenon to build in California.
Yeah.
It took 2 years, and I thought it was terrible, and my buddies are all like, man,
you killed it. Like,
it could have taken you 4. So
I just did a build-to-suit in L.A., and it was, I mean, I think they just moved in. It was 2 years since we signed the lease, and that was just like knocking down a building and building a parking lot. You know, that was not even building a building.
Yeah.
And they was already entitled and developer owned it already, you know. So, 2 years in Sacramento sounds fast. And what's number one thing in your 2024 bucket list vision board? That's my final question for you, my friend.
Well, you asked me earlier what I said at the Christmas party, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it again. I'm going to do big shit in 24. And my people are, and we're not going to make excuses. And, you know, we still don't win every game. We make plenty of mistakes. But
I'm going to do big shit in 24 too.
I know you. We've been friends a long time, and that's what you do. You do big shit.
Hell yeah.
And we're just going to keep doing it,
The only way to be.
We're having fun, and, you know, we're going to have some problems. We're going to have some obstacles, and we're going to have some wins, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just time to roll up our sleeves and, you know, go grind. You know, that's what we do. It's what you do.
That's right. So that's what we do. How do people track you down, Clint Riley?
Well, I'll give you my cell phone number. Clint Riley, 214-226-4626.
Don't text anything inappropriate to
him. Yeah, don't. My kids will get it, but hey, man, You don't have to follow me on Instagram or anything. If you want to talk, call me up or we'll go to breakfast.
What's your website?
Yeah. Text my...
Clint flies under the radar. Just call his cell.
Call my cell. You want to talk?
He'll be fine.
You got a deal for me? There's no... You know, I love guys that email me deals. I also love guys that pick up the phone. That's even better, right? You ever sold a deal on email? Mostly not. Mostly you got to pick up the phone and call a guy. You know, tell him what your story is. Tell him your value proposition. That's how you make money.
In this day and age, nothing's worse than the email negotiation bullshit that keeps going back and forth and back and forth. And you pick up the phone. You can do that in like 20, 30 seconds. What will take you like 2 days in an email exchange. It's insane.
Yep. And
as an efficiency expert, just pick up the phone. Text, say, can I talk to you right now? And then pick up the phone when they're ready and get it done.
Yeah. And
close that deal with people.
Don't be one of those lazy brokers. Like if you want to sell something, pick up the phone, know the facts, have a value proposition. You know, most guys get guilty, and I probably was one of them at some point in time. You know, let's just forward a flyer. Well,
yeah.
Guess what? You want to make 6% or 3% for forwarding a flyer?
Yeah.
You know? It's not really how it works. Pick up the phone. Nora Hogan sold us our first office building, and she had the most meticulous, well thought out opinion on the value, the business plan, who the seller is, what he did right, what he did wrong, what we need to do with it, how long it's going to take. And I think we did something like call her and say, Nora, we'll take it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because she knew what she was selling, and she knew the data. She knew what to do. So,
if you're sitting
in my chair and you want to buy deals, I do want to buy deals. I want to buy deals from everybody in the brokerage community. But also, there's only so much of me to go around, you know.
Yeah.
And we say quick yeses to people that know what the value proposition is and call you with a great reason. Hey, we want you to put 20 man of capital in this, and here's why.
Yeah.
So hey, call me with a great story, and you know, we'll do our part and make you look good as a broker too. You know, we love brokers. You know, they make the world go around. And, you know, fortunately there are a lot of good ones here in Dallas-Fort Worth. And, there have been a lot of them that have been, you know, instrumental in helping us build this.
I can't thank you enough for taking the time to visit today. Drop so much knowledge. Thanks, my brother.
All right, buddy.
Thanks for trucking on.
Appreciate it. Yep. Thank you.
Always. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this episode of Truckin' On. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't be shy. Please like, share, leave a 5-star review so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Stay safe out there on the road. Keep on truckin'.
So much shame when I share my little lies. No one left to blame until I stare into these eyes. I'm gonna tell the truth to you till I break on through to the other side. Living like I'm gonna die is the only time I feel alive. Living like I'm gonna die is the only time I feel alive. And I'm trucking on. I'm trucking on. Moving on down the line, another town will do me fine. I'm trucking on, I'm trucking on, and I'm trucking on, I'm trucking on.